Chapter 17 Abroad and at Home. On May 12th, Roger Ailes was scheduled to return to New York from Palm Beach to meet with Peter Thiel, an early and lonely Trump supporter in Silicon Valley who had become increasingly astonished by Trump's unpredictability. Ailes and Thiel, both worried that Trump could bring Trumpism down, were set to discuss the funding and launch of a new cable news network. Thiel would pay for it, and Ailes would bring O'Reilly, Hannity, himself, and maybe Bannon to it. But 2 days before the meeting, Ailes fell in his bathroom and hit his head. Before slipping into a coma, he told his wife not to reschedule the meeting with Thiel. A week later, Ailes, that singular figure in the march from Nixon's silent majority to Reagan's Democrats to Trump's passionate base, was dead. His funeral in Palm Beach on May 20th was quite a study in the currents of right-wing ambivalence and even mortification. Right-wing professionals remained passionate in their outward defense of Trump, but were rattled, if not abashed, among one another. At the funeral, Rush Limbaugh and Laura Ingraham struggled to parse support for Trumpism even as they distanced themselves from Trump himself. The president had surely become the right-wing's meal ticket. He was the ultimate anti-liberal, an authoritarian who was the living embodiment of resistance to authority. He was the exuberant inverse of everything the right wing found patronizing and gullible and sanctimonious about the left. And yet, obviously, Trump was Trump. Careless, capricious, disloyal, far beyond any sort of control. Nobody knew that as well as the people who knew him best. Ailes' wife, Beth, had militantly invited only Ailes' loyalists to the funeral. Anyone who had wavered in her husband's defense since his firing, or had decided that a better future lay with the Murdoch family, was excluded. This put Trump, still enthralled by his new standing with Murdoch, on the other side of the line. Hours and then days, carefully tracked by Beth Ailes, ticked off, without a condolence call from the president. The morning of the funeral, Sean Hannity's private plane took off for Palm Beach from Republic Airport in Farmingdale, Long Island. Accompanying Hannity was a small group of current and former Fox employees, all Ailes and Trump partisans. But each felt some open angst or even incredulity about Trump being Trump. First, there was the difficulty of grasping the Comey rationale, and now his failure to give even a nod to his late friend Ailes. "He's an idiot, obviously," said the former Fox correspondent Liz Trotta. Fox anchor Kimberly Guilfoyle spent much of the flight debating Trump's entreaties to have her replace Sean Spicer at the White House. "There are a lot of issues, including personal survival." As for Hannity himself, his view of the right-wing world was shifting from Fox-centric to Trump-centric. He did not think much more than a year would pass before he, too, would be pushed from the network or find it too inhospitable to stay on. And yet, he was pained by Trump's slavish attentions to Murdoch, who had not only ousted Ailes, but whose conservatism was at best utilitarian. "He was for Hillary," said Hannity. Ruminating out loud, Hannity said he would leave the network and go work full-time for Trump, because nothing was more important than that Trump succeed. In spite of himself, Hannity added, laughing. But he was pissed off that Trump hadn't called Beth. "Mueller," he concluded, drawing deeply on an electronic cigarette, had distracted him. Trump may be a Frankenstein creation, but he was the right wing's creation, the first true right wing original. Hannity could look past the Comey disaster and Jared and the mess in the White House. Still, he hadn't called Beth. "What the fuck is wrong with him?" asked Hannity. Trump believed he was one win away from turning everything around, or perhaps more to the point, one win away from good press that would turn everything around. The fact that he had largely squandered his first 100 days, whose victories should have been the currency of the next 100 days, was immaterial. You could be down in the media one day and then the next have a hit that made you a success. "Big things. We need big things," he said angrily and often. "This isn't big. I need big. Bring me big. Do you even know what big is?" Repeal and replace, infrastructure, true tax reform, the rollout Trump had promised and then depended on Paul Ryan to deliver, was effectively in tatters. Every senior staff member was now maintaining that they shouldn't have done health care, the precursor to the legislative rollout, in the first place. Whose idea was that anyway? The natural default might be to do smaller things, incremental versions of the program, but Trump showed little interest in the small stuff. He became listless and irritable. So, okay, it would have to be peace in the Middle East. For Trump, as for many showmen or press release entrepreneurs, the enemy of everything is complexity and red tape, and the solution for everything is cutting corners. Bypass or ignore the difficulties. Just move in a straight line to the vision, which, if it's bold enough or grandiose enough, will sell itself. In this formula, there is always a series of middlemen who will promise to help you cut the corners, as well as partners who will be happy to piggyback on your grandiosity. Enter the Crown Prince of the House of Saud, Mohammed bin Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, age 31, a.k.a. MBS. The fortuitous circumstance was that the king of Saudi Arabia, MBS's father, was losing it. The consensus in the Saudi royal family about a need to modernize was growing stronger, somewhat. MBS, an inveterate player of video games, was a new sort of personality in the Saudi leadership. He was voluble, open, and expansive, a charmer, and an international player, a canny salesman rather than a remote, taciturn grandee. He had seized the economic portfolio and was pursuing a vision, quite a Trumpian vision, to out-Dubai Dubai and diversify the economy. His would be a new, modern, well, a bit more modern, kingdom. Yes, women would soon be allowed to drive, so thank God self-driving cars were coming. Saudi leadership was marked by age, traditionalism, relative anonymity, and careful consensus thinking. The Saudi royal family, on the other hand, whence the leadership class comes, was often marked by excess, flash, and the partaking of the joys of modernity in foreign ports. MBS, a man in a hurry, was trying to bridge the Saudi royal selves. Global liberal leadership had been all but paralyzed by the election of Donald Trump, indeed, by the very existence of Donald Trump. But it was an inverted universe in the Middle East. The Obama truculence and hyper-rationalization and micromanaging, preceded by the Bush moral militarism and ensuing disruptions, preceded by Clinton deal-making, quid pro quo, and backstabbing, had opened the way for Trump's version of real politic. He had no patience with the our-hands-are-tied ennui of the post-Cold War order, that sense of the chessboard locked in place, of incremental movement being the best-case scenario, the alternative being only war. His was a much simpler view. Who's got the power? Give me his number. And, just as basically, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. If Trump had one fixed point of reference in the Middle East, it was, mostly courtesy of Michael Flynn's tutoring, that Iran was the bad guy. Hence, everybody opposed to Iran was a pretty good guy. After the election, MBS had reached out to Kushner. In the confusion of the Trump transition, nobody with foreign policy stature and an international network had been put in place. Even the new Secretary of State designate, Rex Tillerson, had no real experience in foreign policy. To bewildered foreign secretaries, it seemed logical to see the president-elect's son-in-law as a figure of stability. Whatever happened, he would be there. And for certain regimes, especially the family-centric Saudis, Kushner, the son-in-law, was much more reassuring than a policy person. He wasn't in his job because of his ideas. Of the many Trump gashes in modern major power governing, you could certainly drive a Trojan horse through his lack of foreign policy particulars and relationships. This presented a do-over opportunity for the world in its relationship with the United States. Or it did, if you were willing to speak the new Trump language, whatever that was. There wasn't much of a roadmap here, just pure opportunism, a new transactional openness, or even more, a chance to use the powers of charm and seduction to which Trump responded as enthusiastically as he did to offers of advantageous new deals. It was Kissinger-esque realpolitik. Kissinger himself, long familiar with Trump by way of the New York social world, and now taking Kushner under his wing, was successfully reinserting himself, helping to organize meetings with the Chinese and the Russians. Most of America's usual partners, and even many antagonists, were unsettled, if not horrified. Still, some saw opportunity. The Russians could see a free pass on the Ukraine and Georgia, as well as a lifting of sanctions, in return for giving up on Iran and Syria. Early in the transition, a high-ranking official in the Turkish government reached out in genuine confusion to a prominent U.S. business figure to inquire whether Turkey would have better leverage by putting pressure on the U.S. military presence in Turkey, or by offering the new president an enviable hotel site on the Bosporus. There was something curiously aligned between the Trump family and MBS. Like the entire Saudi leadership, MBS had, practically speaking, no education outside of Saudi Arabia. In the past, this had worked to limit the Saudi options. Nobody was equipped to confidently explore new intellectual possibilities. As a consequence, everybody was wary of trying to get them to imagine change. But MBS and Trump were on pretty much equal footing. Knowing little made them oddly comfortable with each other. When MBS offered himself to Kushner as his guy in the Saudi kingdom, that was like meeting someone nice at your first day of boarding school, said Kushner's friend. Casting aside, in very quick order, previously held assumptions, in fact, not really aware of those assumptions, the new Trump thinking about the Middle East became the following. There are basically four players, or at least we can forget everybody else: Israel, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. The first three can be united against the fourth, and Egypt and Saudi Arabia, given what they want with respect to Iran and anything else that does not interfere with the United States' interests, will pressure the Palestinians to make a deal. Voila! This represented a queasy-making mishmash of thought. Bannon's isolationism, a pox on all your houses and keep us out of it, Flynn's anti-Iranism, of all the world's perfidy and toxicity, there is none like that of the mullahs, and Kushner's Kissingerism, not so much Kissingerism as having no point of view himself, a dutiful attempt to follow the 94-year-old's advice. But the fundamental point was that the last three administrations had gotten the Middle East wrong. It was impossible to overstate how much contempt the Trump people felt for the business-as-usual thinking that had gotten it so wrong. Hence, the new operating principle was simple. Do the opposite of what they, Obama, the Bush neocons too, would do. Their behavior, their conceits, their ideas, in some sense even their backgrounds, education, and class, were all suspect. And what's more, you don't really have to know all that much yourself. You just do it differently than it was done before. The old foreign policy was based on the idea of nuance. Facing an infinitely complex multilateral algebra of threats, interests, incentives, deals, and ever-evolving relationships, we strain to reach a balanced future. In practice, the new foreign policy, an effective Trump doctrine, was to reduce the board to three elements: powers we can work with, powers we cannot work with, and those without enough power whom we can functionally disregard or sacrifice. It was Cold War stuff, and indeed, in the larger Trump view, it was during the Cold War that time and circumstance gave the United States its greatest global advantage. That was when America was great. Kushner was the driver of the Trump doctrine. His test cases were China, Mexico, Canada, and Saudi Arabia. He offered each country the opportunity to make his father-in-law happy. In the first days of the administration, Mexico blew its chance. In transcripts of conversations between Trump and Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto that would later become public, it was vividly clear that Mexico did not understand or was unwilling to play the new game. The Mexican president refused to construct a pretense for paying for the wall, a pretense that might have redounded to his vast advantage, without his having to actually pay for the wall. Not long after, Canada's new Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, a 45-year-old globalist in the style of Clinton and Blair, came to Washington and repeatedly smiled and bit his tongue. And that did the trick. Canada quickly became Trump's new best friend. The Chinese, who Trump had oft-maligned during the campaign, came to Mar-a-Lago for a summit advanced by Kushner and Kissinger. This required some tutoring for Trump, who referred to the Chinese leader as Mr. Xi. The president was told to think of him as a woman and call him Xi. They were in an agreeable mood, evidently willing to humor Trump, and they quickly figured out that if you flatter him, he flatters you. But it was the Saudis, also often maligned during the campaign, who, with their intuitive understanding of family, ceremony, and ritual and propriety, truly scored. The foreign policy establishment had a long and well-honed relationship with MBS's rival, the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, MBN. Key NSA and State Department figures were alarmed that Kushner's discussions and fast-advancing relationship with MBS would send a dangerous message to MBN, and of course it did. The foreign policy people led by MBS, whose real views were entirely untested, the Kushner view was either naively that he wasn't being led, or with the confidence of a 36-year-old assuming the new prerogatives of the man in charge, that he didn't care. Let's embrace anybody who will embrace us. The Kushner-MBS plan that emerged was straightforward in a way that foreign policy usually isn't. If you give us what we want, we'll give you what you want. On MBS's assurance that he would deliver some seriously good news, he was invited to visit the White House in March. The Saudis arrived with a big delegation, but they were received at the White House by only the president's small circle. And the Saudis took particular note that Trump ordered Priebus to jump up and fetch him things during the meeting. The two large men, the older Trump and much younger MBS, both charmers, flatterers, and country club jokers, each in their way, grandly hit it off. It was an aggressive bit of diplomacy. MBS was using this Trump embrace as part of his own power play in the kingdom, and the Trump White House, ever denying this was the case, let him. In return, MBS offered a basket of deals and announcements that would coincide with a scheduled presidential visit to Saudi Arabia, Trump's first trip abroad. Trump would get a win. Planned before the Comey firing and Mueller hiring, the trip had State Department professionals alarmed. The itinerary, May 19th to May 27th, was too long for any president, particularly such an untested and untutored one. Trump himself, full of phobias about travel and unfamiliar locations, had been grumbling about the burdens of the trip. But coming immediately after Comey and Mueller, it was a get-out-of-dodge godsend. There couldn't have been a better time to be making headlines far from Washington. A road trip could transform everything. Almost the entire West Wing, along with the State Department and National Security staff, was on board for the trip. Melania Trump, Ivanka Trump, Jared Kushner, Reince Priebus, Stephen Bannon, Gary Cohn, Dina Powell, Hope Hicks, Sean Spicer, Stephen Miller, Joe Hagan, Rex Tillerson, and Michael Anton. Also included were Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the Deputy Press Secretary, Dan Scavino, the administration's social media director, Keith Schiller, the president's personal security advisor, and Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary. Ross was widely ridiculed for never missing an Air Force One opportunity. As Bannon put it, Wilbur is Zelig. Every time you turn around, he's in a picture. This trip and the robust American delegation was the antidote and alternate universe to the Mueller appointment. The president and his son-in-law could barely contain their confidence and enthusiasm. They felt certain that they had set out on the road to peace in the Middle East. And in this, they were much like a number of other administrations that had come before them. Trump was effusive in his praise for Kushner. "Jared's gotten the Arabs totally on our side. Done deal," he assured one of his after-dinner callers before leaving on the trip. "It's going to be beautiful." He believed, said the caller, that this trip could pull it out like a twist in a bad movie. On the empty roads of Riyadh, the presidential motorcade passed billboards with pictures of Trump and the Saudi king, MBS's 81-year-old father, with the legend, "Together we prevail." In part, the president's enthusiasm seemed to be born out of, or perhaps had caused, a substantial exaggeration of what had actually been agreed to during the negotiations ahead of the trip. In the days before his departure, he was telling people that the Saudis were going to finance an entirely new military presence in the kingdom, supplanting and even replacing the U.S. command headquarters in Qatar. And there would be the biggest breakthrough in Israel-Palestine negotiations ever. It would be the game changer, major like has never been seen. In truth, his version of what would be accomplished was a quantum leap beyond what was actually agreed. But that did not seem to alter his feelings of zeal and delight. The Saudis would immediately buy $110 billion worth of American arms and a total of $350 billion over 10 years. Hundreds of billions of dollars of investments into the United States and jobs, declared the president. Plus, the Americans and the Saudis would together counter violent extremist messaging, disrupt financing of terrorism, and advance defense cooperation. And they would establish a center in Riyadh to fight extremism. And if this was not exactly peace in the Middle East, the president, according to the Secretary of State, feels like there's a moment in time here. The president's going to talk with Netanyahu about the process going forward. He's going to be talking to President Abbas about what he feels is necessary for the Palestinians to be successful. It was all a Trumpian big deal. Meanwhile, the first family, POTUS, FLOTUS, and Jared and Ivanka, were ferried around in gold golf carts, and the Saudis threw a $75 million party in Trump's honor, with Trump getting to sit on a throne-like chair. The president, while receiving an honor from the Saudi king, appeared in a photograph to have bowed, arousing some right-wing ire. 50 Arab and Muslim nations were summoned by the Saudis to pay the president court. The president called home to tell his friends how natural and easy this was, and how, inexplicably and suspiciously, Obama had messed it all up. "There has been a little strain, but there won't be strain with this administration," the president assured Hamad bin Isa al-Khalifa, the king of Bahrain. Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, the Egyptian strongman, ably stroked the president and said, "You are a unique personality that is capable of doing the impossible." To Sisi, Trump replied, "Love your shoes. Boy, those shoes. Man." It was, in dramatic ways, a shift in foreign policy attitude and strategy, and its effects were almost immediate. The president, ignoring, if not defying, foreign policy advice, gave a nod to the Saudis' plan to bully Qatar. Trump's view was that Qatar was providing financial support to terror groups. Pay no attention to a similar Saudi history. Only some members of the Saudi royal family had provided such support, went the new reasoning. Within weeks of the trip, MBS, detaining MBN quite in the dead of night, would force him to relinquish the crown prince title, which MBS would then assume for himself. Trump would tell friends that he and Jared had engineered this. "We've put our man on top." From Riyadh, the presidential party went on to Jerusalem, where the president met with Netanyahu and, in Bethlehem, with Abbas, expressing ever greater certainty that, in his third-person guise, Trump will make peace. Then to Rome to meet the Pope. Then to Brussels, where, in character, he meaningfully drew the line between Western alliance-based foreign policy, which had been firmly in place since World War II, and the new America First ethos. In Trump's view, all this should have been presidency-shaping stuff. He couldn't believe his dramatic accomplishments weren't getting bigger play. He was simply in denial, Bannon, Priebus, and others noted, about the continuing and competing Comey and Mueller headlines. One of Trump's deficiencies, a constant in the campaign and so far in the presidency, was his uncertain grasp of cause and effect. Until now, whatever problems he might have caused in the past had reliably been supplanted by new events, giving him the confidence that one bad story can always be replaced by a better, more dramatic story. He could always change the conversation. The Saudi trip and his bold campaign to upend the old foreign policy world order should have accomplished exactly that. But the president continued to find himself trapped, incredulously on his part, by Comey and Mueller. Nothing seemed to move on from those two events. After the Saudi leg of the trip, Bannon and Priebus, both exhausted by the trip's intense proximity to the president and his family, peeled off and headed back to Washington. It was now their job to deal with what had become, in the White House staff's absence, the actual, even ultimate, presidency-shaping crisis. What did the people around Trump actually think of Trump? This was not just a reasonable question. It was the question those around Trump most asked themselves. They constantly struggled to figure out what they themselves actually thought and what they thought everybody else was truly thinking. Mostly they kept their answers to themselves, but in the instance of Comey and Mueller, beyond all the usual dodging and weaving and rationalizations, there really wasn't anybody, other than the president's family, who didn't very pointedly blame Trump himself. This was the point at which an emperor's new clothes threshold was crossed. Now you could, out loud, rather freely doubt his judgment, acumen, and most of all, the advice he was getting. "He's not only crazy," declared Tom Barrack to a friend. "He's stupid." But Bannon, along with Priebus, had strongly opposed the Comey firing, while Ivanka and Jared had not only supported it, but insisted on it. This seismic event prompted a new theme from Bannon, repeated by him widely, which was that every piece of advice from the couple was bad advice. Nobody now believed that firing Comey was a good idea. Even the president seemed sheepish. Hence, Bannon saw his new role as saving Trump, and Trump would always need saving. He might be a brilliant actor, but he could not manage his own career. And for Bannon, this new challenge brought a clear benefit. When Trump's fortune sank, Bannon's rose. On the trip to the Middle East, Bannon went to work. He became focused on the figure of Lanny Davis, one of the Clinton impeachment lawyers who, for the better part of 2 years, became a near round-the-clock spokesperson and public defender of the Clinton White House. Bannon judged Comey Mueller to be as threatening to the Trump White House as Monica Lewinsky and Ken Starr were to the Clinton White House, and he saw the model for escaping a mortal fate in the Clinton response. What the Clintons did was to go to the mattress with amazing discipline, he explained. They set up an outside shop, and then Bill and Hillary never mentioned it again. They ground through it. Starr had them dead to rights, and they got through it. Bannon knew exactly what needed to be done. Seal off the West Wing and build a separate legal and communication staff to defend the president. In this construct, the president would occupy a parallel reality, removed from and uninvolved with what would become an obvious partisan blood sport, as it had in the Clinton model. Politics would be relegated to its nasty corner, and Trump would conduct himself as the president and as the commander-in-chief. "So we're going to do it," insisted Bannon, with joie de guerre and manic energy, "the way they did it. Separate war room, separate lawyers, separate spokespeople. It's keeping that fight over there so we can wage this other fight over here. Everybody gets this. Well, maybe not Trump so much. Not clear, maybe a little." Not what he imagined. Bannon, in great excitement, and Priebus, grateful for an excuse to leave the president's side, rushed back to the West Wing to begin to cordon it off. It did not escape Priebus's notice that Bannon had in mind to create a rear guard of defenders, David Bossie, Corey Lewandowski, and Jason Miller, all of whom would be outside spokespeople, that would largely be loyal to him. Most of all, it did not escape Priebus that Bannon was asking the president to play a role entirely out of character, the cool, steady, long-suffering chief executive. And it certainly didn't help that they were unable to hire a law firm with a top-notch white-collar government practice. By the time Bannon and Priebus were back in Washington, 3 blue-chip firms had said no. All of them were afraid they would face a rebellion among the younger staff if they represented Trump, afraid Trump would publicly humiliate them if the going got tough, and afraid Trump would stiff them for the bill. In the end, 9 top firms turned them down.